Hello, ladies and gentlemen, friends. Greg Kokel here at Standard, and well, it's been a crazy week for me. I just got back from Wisconsin just a couple of days ago. In fact, the last broadcast I did from Wisconsin, and when I got there about a week ago because I had an event in Chicago, I was welcomed with a massive tree falling down in my yard right across my driveway. Matter of fact, there were two of them. Fortunately, neither of these big, giant hardwood trees hit the house, the cabin, which we had been remodeling for the last 2 years. We had some lumber to cut up. But anyway, that was a wake-up call. Glad to be back here, though, and talking with you from my home station. And this month, August, we are launching an effort just like we did last summer to add 100 people to the ranks of our strategic partners by the end of the month. That'd be August 31st. And I would like you to think about being one of those 100. Now, just to bring you up to speed, and many of you have heard about strategic partners before, partly not because I've talked about it much, but because there's been a lot of people who have called in who are strategic partners, and before they asked a question, made their comment, got engaged in conversation, they said, look, I just want to do a shout out to the audience. I'm a strategic partner and you ought to become one too. So our strategic partners are passionate people, and they are called strategic partners because they pledge financial support to Stand to Reason with an automatic monthly gift, okay? And they give our work the kind of financial stability that we need to pursue our vision, to train Christians to think clearly, to train Christians to share Christ and the Christian view of reality with the confidence and the courage that we help them to have. Okay. And kind of kicking things off here at the beginning of the month, talking about it on the show, I would like you to hear from a longtime friend of mine who not only is a strategic partner, but has the long view of me and STR. I'm laughing because it's been a long time that we've known each other. You know, I've had many discipleship groups over the last, nearly 47 years as a Christian. But I think my most memorable one was a wonderful group of about eight people in 1989. Oh, man, that was a long time ago. That was the year before I started radio. And most of those friendships actually still endure today. And one especially has been a standout for me, not only because he's a dear friend for over 30 years now, but he's also been an active financial strategic partner with Stand to Reason for almost from the beginning, just about. And he is currently a board member with us at STR. His name is Martin Cavesa. And Marty, you have had the long look, so to speak, on both me and Stand to Reason over the last 30 years. I mean, could you have imagined back in 1989 as part of our group what God would be doing in our lives now through Stand to Reason 3 decades later?
Well, no, Greg, I don't think I could imagine that. But, you know, I know enough to know that anytime you try to think about what God's going to be doing, you could be welcomed with quite a surprise. So I did not know this was going to be happening way back then. But what I do know is, you know, that group to me was really important as well. And I can't believe it's been over 30 years. Mm-hmm. But that time was so precious and sweet because, you know, I was a fairly new Christian then. And to be in part of a group and be discipled by you and be surrounded by others to set that foundation for my Christian walk. Excuse me. You know, that was so important. I think that's such an important role for us. You know, anytime a new Christian comes in, they really need to begin to get that firm foundation. And that's certainly what that discipleship group was for me. Mm-hmm. And it's no surprise now, 30 years later, when you see what Stand to Reason's doing now, how we're essentially doing that same thing. You're equipping Christian ambassadors, you know, with knowledge and wisdom and character, and to disciple Christians to understand how to not only continue to grow in their faith, but to be able to use the tactics and the things that they can learn through Stand to Reason to be an apologetic for their faith and be able to talk with other people and about their faith. And I think that's vitally important. So not only was it important back then, that group, but now I see how much it's grown into what it is now with Stand mm-hmm. Reason, and it's really been the same.
Well, you've taken a much more active role in the beginning as financially being part of what we're doing, you know, as a friend, getting things rolling, and then making a strategic partner commitment over time as we kind of develop that particular strategy, and then coming on board as a board member to help lead the enterprise. How long have you been a board member now? I'm trying to recall. Have I lose track of time?
I was trying to think about how long it's been, and I think it's close to 7 years. I know it's been at least five, but I think it's maybe seven. I'm not really sure.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I appreciate about our board is the variety that we have there. You being, you know, a creative businessman, inventor, you were very high profile there over at Mattel in creating new – was it Mattel? Is that right?
Yeah,
Mattel. Creating all these crazy toys and everything and now doing other things, of course, but bringing that kind of expertise to our board. And that's important for our leadership because we don't have just a whole bunch of like pastor types who kind of give their insight. We need business insight. We need creative insight. And you've been able to provide that for us, Marty. But I want you to be able to tell our listeners who I'm challenging to think about being one of the 100 this month, the 100 new strategic partners. What were your personal reasons for taking such an active part in Stand to Reason as a strategic partner and then eventually as a board person?
Well, you know, when I first started giving to Stand to Reason, going back to that discipleship group, I remember that there was one particular section we talked about in discipleship group about finances and understanding how to be responsible with your finances, but also understanding, you know, the value in giving back to God's kingdom through your finances as well. And and so from the get-go, you know, I've kind of taken that on to just know that there was a responsibility for me to give to the kingdom in that sense, you know, where your heart is. And so I wanted to do that. And Stand to Reason was one of those enterprises that I just from the beginning knew that it was something important in my life. And because it was important, I wanted to help give back in that sense. And now it's, to me, it's more of not a giving back, but it's a paying forward, because I think about, you know, when I'm giving to Stand to Reason, what I'm essentially doing is paying forward for somebody else like me who needed to be equipped. And I still need to be equipped. It's not like I'm fully equipped by any means. You know, I listen to Stand to Reason. I gather their resources. I go to the website. And when I think about how right now my giving is paying it forward so that there can be other people like I was as a young Christian or like I am even now that need to be discipled, so to speak, need to be equipped and need to be able to learn valuable things about their faith and how to continue to move forward in their walk in a solid way with a solid foundation.
You know, Marty, I am so glad you put it that particular way because I've thought about this a lot. This is kind of a two-step thing. And when we started STR, my idea was when it comes to development, we are never going to ask anybody to give anything unless we've given to them first. And this has been a standard approach from the outset. But my thinking is if we are giving and people are receiving, then people are going to say, you know, I want to respond by saying thank you and helping out and kind of giving back for that reason, for what they've received. But I think there's a maturation process here that you have just described. We have a lot of people who've been on board for a long time. And I think they got on board for that reason I just described. They said, I've received, I want to give back, okay, to the organization I've received from. And that's a basic biblical principle, okay, find in Galatians 6. However, it's matured into saying, you know what, I want to do more than that. I want to partner. I want to be part of the impact that this organization is having in the lives of other people. I want to, as you put it, pay it forward. And I think that has been a very powerful reason why many people who are strategic partners now want to be involved, because they realize the impact that they are having in other people's lives through us.
Totally.
And that's
agree.
What you just described.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. What would you say to others, maybe that you haven't said already, and maybe you've covered the basis here, but others who've been around Standard Reason for a while, you know, and who have listened to our shows, and I'm glad for that, and used our website, I'm thrilled about that, used our training materials, fabulous, it's there. Reading our books, who might have thought about partnering with us as a strategic partner in this very particular kind of role, being part of that community of special folk at Standard Reason, but haven't made that decision yet. Now, they've toyed with the idea, but they, well, maybe one of these days kind of thing. What would you say to them?
Well, you know, I guess the thing that comes to mind is, you know, any relationship needs to be nurtured, whether it's my relationship with God or my wife or my family. It's, you know, you need some sense of nurture in that relationship. And if you have a relationship with Standard Reason and you have been receiving, I think, you know, nurturing that relationship to say, how can I give back is really, really important. But taking it one step further, if you just not only see it as how can I give back, but when you start thinking about not just your relationship to Standard Reason, but Standard Reason's relationship with so many people out there that need not only the gospel, but, you know, a firm foundation for their gospel, they need to be able to push that forward and be able to have Standard Reason continue to get their message out. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about what you're giving to Standard Reason is not just paying it back, but you're, like I said earlier, you know, you are in a position now where you're able to help grow God's kingdom with other people that are going to need to, yeah, to hear that message as well.
And just as kind of closing this off here, this is just a reflective question, and I don't know what your answer is going to be, but as I look around right now, to be honest with you, 2 years ago, I was saying, I cannot imagine the way things are now. I never would have guessed they would get to this spot. That was 2 years ago. But 2 years ago, I never would have guessed we are facing, as a body of Christ, what we're facing in our culture now. It's like every year I get surprised. Like, it can't get any more bizarre,
right?
Yet it does. And I'm just, do you have any reflections on that? Because this is the world that we are sending our people in, and our strategic partners are sending the rest, Standard Reason, into that world to train Christians to meet those needs. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I've got a daughter who's in high school, and so for 3 more years she's going to be in high school, then going to college. And I just think about how colleges have they mold minds, but we see such a movement towards a way that is not leaning towards what the gospel really is about. And mm-hmm. I'm fearful for young people when they go into college atmosphere now and what they're actually hearing and learning. And so that to me just sparks of how important it is that people need to hear a clear gospel. They need to hear the truth, and they really can't be swayed by all these influences that are going on in this world right now, and how divisive this world is right now.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so if they don't have that firm foundation, and particularly young college students, young minds, young Christians, I mean, they need to understand what the gospel is about, and the truth of that and the importance of that. And it's going to be very easy to be swayed by what's going on in this world right now, in particular when you start hearing about things that are so crazy and they're being touted as this is what you should be doing, or this is the mm-hmm. truth now, and it's mm-hmm. the opposite of what it should be.
Well, I just read yesterday that they're burning Bibles in Portland now.
Oh,
That's part of the enterprise up there. So just FYI to the world here. My goodness. Marty, any final words for those who might be sitting on the fence right now who are thinking about becoming a strategic partner? I'll tell you folks how to do that in just a moment. It's really simple, but any final words for them?
I would just say, continue to pray about it and understand that God wants us to be part of this, of giving back. God wants us to be part of moving it forward. God wants us to go out there and make disciples of all mm-hmm. nations. And this is one way that you can do that. You know, if you can't do it in other ways, that's understandable, but there's one way that you can, and that is through an organization like this that is really solid and really just having a great impact. It has had it for my own life, and hopefully it has for you all as well. And so there's a good chance that if you pray about it, you know, you'll be able to understand how important it is and see that it's a good opportunity to give back.
Yeah. Well, Marty, it is really sweet to talk to you. I want to thank you for your friendship all of these years. It's been really, really great. And all your wonderful support and encouragement to me personally and also to Stand to Reason. So I'll see you at the next board meeting, brother.
Sounds great. God bless.
All the best to you, brother.
Bye-bye.
Marty Cabeza, one of our board members, longtime friend. I remember on our last meeting, we were having dinner at a restaurant. We were kind of closing off the that meeting of discipleship group. And that was when I announced to them that I had been offered a radio show. And I started the radio show just a couple of months later. And that started a 30-year career in radio. Anyway, when you sign up in August to become a new strategic partner with an automatic monthly gift of $25 or more, I want to tell you what we're going to do. We're going to send you a kind of way of saying thank you, but in a way that's very consistent with what we're trying to accomplish. We're going to send you an SDR Tactics gift pack, okay? And, well, actually, we're not going to send it to you. We are going to send it to the pastor of your choice or the leader that you designate. Now, if you want to keep it yourself, you're welcome to do that. But it's going to be the book, Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. It's going to be the Tactics Video Study DVD with 6 in-depth sessions there. And there's going to be a quick reference card with a free video download of Tactics in Engaging False Ideas. So you can see this is all tactics-oriented. Why? Because we want your gift to be an example of paying things forward. You sign up as a new strategic partner, and we're going to give you a way of influencing the leadership in your spiritual community with this material that has helped so many other people. And I'm just going to promise you 2 things for becoming a strategic partner, okay? And one of them is you are going to have a direct and active part in an enterprise that God has been aggressively blessing for 27 years now with wonderful fruit. And the second thing, I can promise you a deep sense of satisfaction that you are partnering with us to make a difference. Even though you can't be directly on the front line in the way we are, you're still going to be making a difference. And I know the first thing, that you'll be taking an active part in an enterprise God is blessing, because I see it happening. But I know the second thing, what it's going to make you feel like, because I have strategic partners tell me that all the time. They tell me that personally. They tell me that when they call in on the air. And then they encourage you guys to become a strategic partner. Okay. So here's what you do. You go to str.org/partner. Very simple. str.org/partner. I just did it. Went right to the page. All the information is there. We've also got a running total. We just started this a couple days. We're shooting for 100 this month. We want you to be one of the 100. We've got 12 already. We're 12% there. And I'm looking for 30 after this broadcast, which goes out this week. And so I'm asking you to be one of the 18 that can be added to the 12 to make it 30 for our first week. What do you think? str.org/partner. All the details are there. We'd love to have you on board. Be one of those 18 today. All right? Let's go to a break, and then we got a bunch of callers hanging on to chat. We'll do that in just a moment. on Stand to Reason.
Did you know Stand to Reason has a YouTube channel? We release a new video each Monday on the topics you care about. Through short, engaging videos, our speakers train you on tactics, offer apologetics tips, answer common theology questions, and address big issues in the world today. Join tens of thousands of other subscribers so you can stay up to date when we release a new video. Just go to youtube.com and search STR Videos, all one word, and hit the subscribe button. That's STR Videos. Take advantage of this free resource to help you stay informed, encouraged, and equipped as you share your worldview with others.
Some people treat Christianity like it's a build-your-own Sunday shop. They include the bits they like and exclude the bits they don't. The problem is, truth is not ice cream. You can't build your own biblical reality like you build an ice cream sundae. You can't pick and choose the parts you prefer. Truth doesn't work like that. Truth is what matches up with reality. Sadly, there are some who are creating a version of Christianity that fits their own subjective desire rather than sound doctrine. At this year's STR Reality Conferences, you will get the tools to identify counterfeit versions of Christianity so you can guard against them. We want to show you that biblical reality isn't something we shape, rather, it's something that shapes us. So join us at one of this year's STR Reality Conferences. Discover why truth is not ice cream by visiting realityapologetics.com and registering today.
Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Tuesday, mostly every Tuesday. But that's the time to call in the show if you'd like to call in and raise an issue, ask a question, that kind of thing. And I'm just looking for my sheet. There it is, that has the numbers. 855-243-9975 is the number. And if you're calling in internationally, you can dial up 562-424-8229. Remember to do that during the showtime, Tuesdays, 4 until 6 p.m. I staggered there for a moment and balked because last week I had to make a two-hour adjustment since I was in Wisconsin. But 4 to 6 p.m. Los Angeles time. And we got Joshua in Louisiana here who's called in. Joshua, welcome to the show. Glad you've joined us.
Hey, Mr. Kokel. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, sir.
Good. Well, first off, I just want to thank you for your, or you and the organization as a whole for your work. I've been a fan for about 10 years, and just say
great.
You played a major role in what I call my exodus from Pentecostalism.
Mm.
So just a little
thank you
there.
You're so welcome.
You may have what I told Amy there in front of you, but I've been engaging in a conversation with a Muslim that I met. The first thing I did is I got Alan's quick reference guide on Islam.
Right. That's Alan Schliemann from Stand to Reason. He's written a great ambassador's guide that gives some very good insightful approaches to dealing with Muslims and Muslim objections to Christianity, right?
Yes, sir. Very helpful.
Mm, good.
The two things that I brought up to my Muslim friend was that what Alan had laid out is the two contingents that the Quran establishes the gospel as an authoritative source.
Mm-hmm.
Second, the Quran says that the word of Allah, which in this case would be the gospel, cannot be corrupted or changed because
it's
protected by him. And what I asked was, given that, how could the Quran say that Jesus did not die? Well, the gospels claim that he did. And I suspected his response, based on my interaction with the media and resources that you all have provided. And his response was in the form of videos of a Muslim apologist, theologian type.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could, I would like to give those three main points that he gave.
Yeah, if you can give, in a sense, the essence of it or a summary of it, that would be
yes.
fine.
Okay. The first is that Jesus was not crucified, or he didn't die on the cross. The second, Jesus was never asked to be worshipped. The third, Jesus was the only messenger who the disciples mistook as divine. And I have formulated a 7-point response. It's a whole 2-page thing, but to respect your time, I've just in a few words for you, I have 7 points that I've
Okay, let me ask you this before you go into your 7 points. If these are the questions that they've offered you and you have worked out points in response, what is it that I can help you with right now?
Certainly. What I was going to do is offer those to you and see if there's anything that you might could add to it or maybe provide an observation that would maximize
Okay. I'm sure that you've done some really good work with those, but let me do it this way. This might be a little bit more parsimonious time-wise with other callers on board. Why don't you let me give my responses, or at least in summary, and you'll see if whether I've covered the same ground you did or maybe I said something different. Chances are you have covered more ground than I'm going to cover in this, but I think that might be a little bit better way of going about this. So let me take them one by one. Is that all right?
Yes, sir.
Jesus was not.
Yes, certainly.
Okay, Jesus was not crucified. Now, this is a claim about an event that took place in history. Jesus was not crucified. Now, my question to the person the Muslim who makes this claim will be, why would you say that? Now, I know, of course, the reason that they say that is because this is what the Quran represents to them. As not what the New Testament represents to them. And I asked this question here now of a Muslim once in a conversation much like this. And I asked, the question I asked was this: who do you think is in a better position to say what happened in Jesus' life? People who were witnesses to the events themselves and wrote largely at the time of Jesus, or someone who wrote 600 years later, which would be Muhammad. So, I mean, I think this is a fair question. This is simply a question about what happened in history. At this point, we're not putting any theological significance to it, but of course there are theological ramifications for Christianity if Jesus was not crucified. But the claim that is being made by Muslims is this claim about history. So what do historians say regarding that claim? Well, historians are virtually unanimous that Jesus was crucified on a Roman cross. What happened after that? There are differences of opinions. But the reason that they're virtually unanimous is because we have early reliable records, multiple references to that fact. So my question is going to be, on the basis of what is your Muslim friend rejecting the historical record and asserting something contrary to the historical record? Okay? So that's the direction I'm going to go on the first one. That makes sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. The second one is Jesus did not ask to be worshipped. I'm not sure why that's relevant, to be honest with you. In the book of Revelation, we have the Apostle John receiving the revelation, and in the last chapter, he falls down before an angel and worships the angel, okay? And the angel says, don't do that. Worship God alone. So we have some evidence, and this isn't the only place this happens, but this is a kind of a famous place. It's right there at the end. What we have is a clear indication that when worship is being given to the wrong individual, that individual, spiritual individual, corrects the disciple in this case immediately and in very strong terms. Stop that. Don't do that. But when worship was given to Jesus, Jesus did not stop them. And that seems to me to be the relevant point. Not that, well, Jesus never asked for worship, although even that point is not entirely accurate. Because in John chapter 5, where Jesus is accused of making himself out to be equal with God, Jesus goes on then to complicate things by saying that we are to honor, and the Jews are to honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Whoa. How do we show honor to the Father? Well, one way is to worship him. And so Jesus is claiming that whatever honor or obeisance we show to the Father is due him as well. Now, that sounds to me pretty much like Jesus claiming that worship is due him. Okay, but even if he didn't say that, which he did, that's in the record, the fact that he was worshiped and he did not rebuke his disciples for doing so shows that he approved of their behavior. Jesus was a Torah-observant Jew, and just like the angel who rebuked John, if he saw his disciples worshiping him and this wasn't right, he would have corrected them immediately. They were his disciples, after all. Now, I mean, your Muslim friend may not like the claim of the deity of Christ. Okay, fine. But what he can't do, I think, in fairness, is to assert that that especially in the case of worship, this wasn't going on in the New Testament with regards to Jesus. It was, and there's many examples of it. Proskuneo is the Greek word that means worship. It actually means to bow down. And it could mean that somebody is just, you know, kind of showing respect. But if somebody's on their face, they're already down on their face, and then the text said, and they proskuneoed, they can't get down any lower again. They're already down. When it has that word in there, it means that they are worshiping Jesus, okay? To which Jesus does not object, which means he must have approved. The silence in this case is an indication of his approval. Okay. Now, the last point was that the Muslim friend of yours mistook Jesus as divine. Well, my question would be, what would cause a first century Jew to mistake a human being as divine? What would cause that? Why would anybody say that? And my point here is that they had no inclination to look around to find a God-man. They had no idea that God would become a human being. And they were mystified when there was an indication of such. But notice that when Jesus calmed the storm, the Sea of Galilee, they said, "Who is this person who controls even the forces of nature?" And that's one of the occasions where they fell down and proskuneoed, because they realized this person who controlled the forces of nature the way Jesus did was the creator of nature to begin with. That was their conclusion, which is why they worshipped him. So I don't understand when they says that the disciples mistook Jesus as divine, when there would be no inclination to think that in the first place. The reason they might, against their prejudices, begin to think that Jesus was divine was because of the things Jesus said and the things that Jesus did. And that slowly won them over, almost against their will, because they had a great theological prejudice, understandable, against God becoming a man. Pardon me? I'm hearing someone that I didn't expect to hear. Hello?
I'm still here.
No, I'm hearing Amy. And I don't... Do I still have Joshua?
I'm still here.
Is Joshua still on board here? I don't see... Okay, well, I hear staffers talking in my headset, and I don't know if that's on the air or not, but I don't hear Joshua. And looking at the time right now, it might be time to take a break, and if we have some technical difficulties, we can work this out. But Joshua, what I've tried to do is to offer a very clear response and hopefully refutation of the mere claims that were made by your Muslim friend. Jesus was not crucified. Really? Where'd you get that idea? The historical records support that he was, and so do the historians. Jesus didn't ask for worship. That's not relevant. He received it. But in fact, he did kind of ask for worship in John chapter 5. He said it was appropriate that all honor him as they honor the Father. And then that the disciples just mistook him for divine. They had no inclination to do that. They had reasons to change their view, their disinclination, because of things that Jesus said and because of things that Jesus did. All right, let's take a break, and we'll be back with more of your questions on Stand to Reason.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible, and relevant content each week? As a nonprofit ministry, we rely on generous supporters in order to provide the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including apps, blog posts, articles, or short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. When you visit str.org/donate, you'll find a newly renovated transaction page that makes it easier than ever to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources over the past 25 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Please help us to continue on into the next 25 years by making a gift today at str.org/donate.
Hey, friends, Greg Kokel back with you here, and I'm not always sure what I'm hearing in my headset is actually heard by you guys, so sometimes I talk about it, maybe you don't hear it. Last week, this got cleared out of the broadcast, fortunately, but there was music in my head. You know, it was like Phantom of the Opera, right? All this music was in my head through my headset, but you weren't hearing it, but I thought you could, and so I'm commenting on it, and it sounds like I'm hallucinating. Anyway, so if there was some confusion for you last segment, my apology, and my apologies to the last caller, but I hope I covered the ground he was concerned with. So let's give it a shot here in Texas and talk to Steve. Welcome, Steve.
Greg, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing okay. Nice to chat with you. What's on your mind?
Nice to chat with you.
Thank you.
I've been dealing with, this has been going on for a long time, a lot of years, and seems like over the last year or so, I have one Calvinist buddy in California and one in Arizona. And I guess my question has to do with determinism. To what extent, is that like the norm for a person that holds a Reformed position to believe in
determinism?
You know, the deterministic view of God, yes.
Well, it's not I'd have to say it's not completely unusual. And of course, a lot depends on what you mean by determinism. You know, it could mean machine-like behavior. I mean, that's the way the physical world operates. And if you just have event causation, that is the physical world, one event causing another event causing another event, these are all linked together like a complicated set of dominoes falling, okay? That's deterministic. And if what you mean is that there are agents who are not caused by any external thing, any external domino falling, to make choices, but you make choices that are consistent with your desires, and so after a fashion, your desires are the, I want to put quotes around the word determining factor here, because this would be considered a kind of soft determinism. That's the term that's used to describe it. Okay, then that's a kind of determinism of sorts, but it's one where individuals are making their own choices, and they're really their own because they're what they want. Okay, now some people consider both equally as rigidly deterministic. Okay, and there's debate about this. Bill Craig, William Lane Craig, the philosopher, he would say, you know, soft determinism and regular hard determinism are both determinism, and the only other alternative is what's called libertarian freedom. So, and that is where you make your own choices, and they are not determined by anything. By any external physical forces or any internal desires, they don't, strictly speaking, determine your choices, okay? Some will say that that kind of freedom requires what they call the CDO condition, I could have done otherwise. So you're free if you could have done this or you could have done that, and it's up to you. Okay, so these are just ways of talking about freedom and determinism. What's interesting to me a little bit is that I think the way the question was first put, is five-point Calvinism deterministic? There's nothing in the 5 points of Calvinism that, in my sense, my understanding, speaks to the broad question of determinism. Okay. Now, in Calvinism, there is an element that is decided by God. In all Reformed thinking, any individual person's salvation is the result of God reaching into a rebellious human being and making whatever changes he needs to make to guarantee that that person is going to put their faith in Jesus. Now, some would consider this an act of violence. I consider it an act because it's a violence against their will, but it's their will that is set against God already, and it will determine their judgment and their eternal damnation unless they're rescued. So there is something that is set in stone, as it were, on the Calvinistic perspective or the Reformed perspective or the five-point tulip perspective, and that is that God saves sinners, to put it simply. That was the summary that was used by, I'm trying to think now, the Reformed thinker who just died. But God saves sinners. That's it. That's the summary of all five of those points. God rescues. And when he rescues who he wants, and he rescues them completely. So I would say that my salvation is determined by God. And God's going to say, this particular thing is going to take place, and I'm going to guarantee that it will happen. But that, of course, is true about a lot of things that God does, and even Arminians will acknowledge this. David said, who resists his will? When God wants to do something, there's no stopping him. So that there are incidents of things that are determined by God should not be theologically controversial. I think one of those incidents is salvation. Now, that doesn't mean, though, and this is where I think a mistake that a lot of people make, if you believe in the tulip, if you will, which is 5 points that are characterizing the Reformed view, and often misunderstood, I think, but none of those, you can believe in each one of those, as I do, without believing in determinism of everything. All those points show is that my salvation is secured and guaranteed by the act and the will of a gracious God. That's what those points indicate. And those that God does not rescue are properly judged for their own rebellion against God. So in one sense, there is a deterministic element in Reformed theology as it touches the issue of salvation, but that there are deterministic elements in the world is not foreign to any theology, because God still makes his decision about what he's going to do about a whole host of things, and he doesn't. And that's what's called the sovereignty of God. How far the sovereignty of God extends is a question that's debated between Calvinists and Arminians. But that God does determine some things, it seems to me pretty straightforward. And in my view, I can hold to the 5 points of Calvinism without committing myself to a worldview that itself is fully deterministic. So I don't think that Calvinism entails determinism writ large. All it entails is determinism with regards to salvation. Some Calvinists do see the grounding for the salvation and the other things God wants to get done is a strict determinism. That's not my view. Does that make any sense, Steve?
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from. I mean, I going back to what you said a minute ago, some things that God does determine, I see that too, some things, mm-hmm. but I don't conclude that he determines all things.
Right.
You know, John Piper has talked about this subject, and he took it a bit further, I think, than most of the big players in Reformed thinking take it. And he was talking about God knows all these things because he performs it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't remember the exact quote, but I know he said he performs it, you know, and the way it's been explained to me by a lot of Calvinists is that God has set in motion and foreordained all things to come to pass. Every thought, deed, action, everything, so that it could not be otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I'm talking to this Reformed person, I got a hold of an old friend on Facebook the other day, and he's a 5-point Calvinist, and he was telling me, he goes, man, you just don't get it. He goes, you're dim-witted. And then later on, he told me, I don't think you're dim-witted. I just think you're stupid. He said, I can't believe you don't see this. And I said, well, according to your view, if I'm understanding it correctly, God has foreordained all these events to happen so they couldn't happen any other way. So seems to me that God's got me right where I'm supposed to be at this point mm-hmm. in time. So mm-hmm. why do you get upset with that?
Yeah, I'm sorry responded that way. I think it's an uncharitable response. And I actually think that the issues are a bit more complicated than the way he's characterized it. There are some people that will ground God's omniscience in his sovereignty. As you just described, the reason God knows what will happen in the future is because he is causing it to happen. To me, that's dangerously close to making God responsible for evil and taking away every bit of freedom that any human being ever has. When you take away all freedom, then what you've lost is you've lost reason and rationality at the same time because you believe things not for reasons but in virtue of determinism. You were determined to believe that regardless of what reasons there happen to be. Now, granted, there are some people who think that way. I don't. And
isn't that kind of what irresistible grace is all about?
Well, the irresistible grace is all about the issue of salvation. That is speaking about one aspect. It isn't speaking about the whole enchilada, so to speak. And that's a distinction that I'm making very aggressively here. And I just want you to see the difference. Now, it turns out that some people who understand that salvation is determined by the grace of God and by his choice also take it further than that, but all the tulip requires, as I understand it, and I don't see, you know, how I'm speaking out of my ken in this particular case, all the tulip requires is that salvation is a work of God from top to bottom. Not every single thing is mechanically determined by God. And that's that's the distinction that I'd like you to hold in your mind. Whatever way that you decide to go in terms of your own theological convictions, okay, believing in sovereign grace regarding salvation, characterized by the tulip, if you like, the 5 points, does not in itself entail a commitment to any form of a large-scale determinism. Still there?
Interesting. Yeah, I'm just trying. Wow. I think for the first time in my life, I've got a disagreement with you.
You're disagreeing that just because God may determine one thing about our life, this follows then that he determines every single thing that's going to happen? Is that what you're suggesting? Unless I misunderstand.
Well, every Reformed person that I've talked to has been very aggressive that, yes, God has foreordained all things, every thought, action, deed, whatever you come up with, that he has set that in motion, that it cannot be otherwise.
But your question wasn't about what Reform people may think in general. Your question was whether 5-point Calvinism is deterministic. And my response is, it is deterministic with regards to the single thing it addresses, and that is soteriology.
Gotcha.
I mean, that's pretty much it. Okay?
Okay.
Okay,
yes,
buddy.
Sir.
All right.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate the call, and they're deep things. All right. Let's go to Fresno here. I've just got, I'm looking at my clock, about 7-6 minutes to go. Oh, no, I just lost somebody. I hate it when I lose somebody. Oh, goodness. Okay, let's just go to Fresno. I already said that. And Daryl, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I want to give you a shout out and say thank you for all the encouragement you have, you and your staff have been providing during these strange times. I remember when we first went into lockdown, and there was that, I think that first episode you did after that, where you just kind of gave us some encouragement and talked about what you guys were doing. That was a very, very helpful thing to have.
Well, thank you. It's an odd, controversial time, but I appreciate that feedback. Thank you, dear.
So we've been going back to our church. Our church is meeting entirely outdoors, and it's been very enjoyable. And we had Lord's Supper for first time since March this last Sunday. And my 9-year-old son was with us, and he would normally we would take him to Sunday school. He has been having Sunday school, so he's been attending big church, as they call it, with us.
Uh-huh.
And so he was asking about communion. Can I have some? And
can I have some?
Mom said, ask your father. And I said, we'll talk about it. And
it's a good answer.
You know, I'm wondering, he says, well, I know what the bread is. And he talks to me, tells me about, the body of Christ, and the juice is the mm-hmm. blood of Christ. And so, of course, my thing is, okay, he's 9. He might want a snack, or he might just be curious to taste this or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
How do I know if my son is ready to take communion?
Well, the issue here is in what theological view a person has of the Lord's table, and there are maybe 3 major views between Roman Catholics and Lutherans and Reformed or other Protestants, and those are noble views. And in 2 cases they are. The 3rd case, I don't agree at all with the Roman Catholic view. But the point for our purposes right now is that the Lord's table is for Christians. And it's to be taken by Christians in a respectful fashion. It isn't just like a generalized fellowship thing, come on down, break bread with us. And so in my case, I have two daughters, one that is not a confessing Christian, so she does not take communion. She's 15. She used to, but she doesn't now. Okay. I have another who is 12, who is a confessing Christian, but she hasn't been baptized yet and that troubles me a little bit. Okay. I mean, it's not a big deal, but so up until now, she hasn't been taking communion. If I were to, you know, and bet my money on it, so to speak, right now, I would say the 12-year-old knows the Lord. But what I would be most comfortable with is her willingness, and we've talked about this a little bit, to be baptized as a public statement of her faith in Christ before she began taking the Lord's Supper. And then it would be fine as she participated in that means of grace and that identification with Christ. So I think that the Lord's Supper is a weighty matter. And Paul talks about this to the Corinthians. Some who have taken it in an unworthy manner have brought judgment on themselves. Some got sick. Some have even died, he talks about. And so we need to be careful about how we handle it, how we manage it, how we approach this. And that's why I think it's good that you are having this conversation with your son and that you have a sober, kind of careful attitude about it. The real issue is whether he's a follower of Christ, and the only way you can know that is by asking him some questions or watching the way he comports himself and how he talks about God. I don't think there's any rush in this, personally. We, as a family, my parents, my wife and I, we were not into and still aren't into rushing to try to get our kids to pray to receive Christ. And we figure as the gospel is presented to them, they are going to trust in their own time and believe, and this is going to manifest itself in the way they talk about it and a desire to get baptized, and then having the Lord's Supper will be a natural part of that. But I'm looking at my clock right now. I think we're out of time. And Daryl, I know you've got a relative on staff here. She's wonderful.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. Got to run, though.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Yes, you're so welcome. And I trust that that answer was useful. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.